Location was everything, and the place was crowded. All the tables were taken, and people were shoulder to shoulder at the bar, except for a quarantine yard around the big guy on the stool. Bottles and glasses were slamming back and forth with regularity, and fives and tens and twenties were heading for the register like a raging river. So Reacher watched a little longer, over the first beer, into a second, taking them slow, and he saw another guy step into the room, and he felt the atmosphere change, like a moment of truth had arrived, like the whole purpose of the evening had snapped into focus. The new guy was dressed one grade better than anyone else, and he moved in from the door with a proprietorial air, his place, the owner. He greeted people as he walked, a little vaguely, a little preoccupied, and then he ducked behind the bar and went in through a small door in back, the office, presumably, his domain. He came out again 2 minutes later, carrying something in his hand. He stayed in the well behind the bar and squeezed past the bartender and stepped over to where the big guy was sitting on his stool. They faced each other with nothing more than the mahogany slab between them. Everyone looked away, except Reacher. He saw the owner hand over the thing he was carrying. He did it fast and unobtrusive, like a magic trick. The guy on the stool took it and slipped it into his pocket. It was there, and then it was gone. But Reacher had seen what it was. It was a white office envelope, fat with cash, protection money, presumably. The guy on the stool stayed where he was and finished his drink, ostentatiously slowly, rubbing it in. He had the power. He was the man. Except he wasn't. He was an underling. He was muscle, that was all. Reacher knew how these things worked. He had seen them before. He knew the envelope would go straight to some shadowy figure at the top of the chain, and the guy on the stool would get a cut, like a wage. The waitress came back and asked if Reacher wanted a third go-round with the Rolling Rock. Reacher said no, and asked, "What happens now?" "About what?" "You know about what." The woman shrugged, like a secret shame had been exposed, and she said, "We stay in business another week. We don't get smashed up or burned out." "How long has this been going on?"
"A year."
"Has anything been done about it?"
"Not by me. I like my face the way it is."
"Me too," Reacher said. She smiled at him. Reacher said, "The owner could do something. There are laws."
"Not unless something happens. The cops say they need to see someone beaten, or worse, or the place in flames."
"What's the guy's name?"
"Does it matter? Who does he work for?"
She pincered her finger and thumb and pretended to zipper her mouth. "I like my face the way it is," she said again, "and I have kids." She collected his empty bottle and headed back to her station. The big guy on the stool finished his drink and put his glass on the bar. He didn't pay, and the barman didn't ask him to. He stood up and walked to the door, through a channel suddenly clear of people. Reacher slid out of his chair and followed. First Street was dark, all except for a yellow light on a pole about a block away. The guy from the stool was 15 feet ahead, upright and mobile. He looked to be about 6'2" and 2'10", not small, but smaller than Reacher. Younger, but almost certainly dumber, and less skilled and less experienced. And more inhibited. Reacher was sure of that. He had yet to meet the man who outranked him in those categories. He called out, "Hey."
The guy from the stool stopped and turned around, surprised. Reacher walked up to him and said, "I think you've got something that doesn't belong to you. I'm sure it was just a mistake, so I want to give you the chance to make it right." "Get lost," the guy said, but he said it without the final few percent of conviction. He wasn't the total king of the jungle, not right then and there. Reacher asked, "How many more calls do you have tonight?" "Butt out, pal. This ain't your business." "So whose business is it?" "Get lost," the guy said again. "It's all about free will," Reacher said. "It's all about making choices. You want to know what yours are?"
"What?"
"You can tell me his name now, or you can tell me after I break your legs."
Whose name?"
"The guy you picked up the money for." Reacher watched his eyes, waited for the decision. There were three possibilities. The guy would run, fight, or talk. He hoped the guy wouldn't run, because then he would have to run after him, and he hated running. He didn't expect the guy to talk because of ego and self-image. Therefore, the guy would have to fight. Or try to. And Reacher was right. The guy fought, or tried to. He lunged forward and swung his left fist downward like a sweep, as if there was a knife in it. An attempt at a distraction, nothing more. Next would come a big straight right, maybe a little overhand. But Reacher wasn't about to wait for it. He had learned to fight a long time ago, in hot, dusty outposts in the Pacific, and cold, damp alleys in Europe, and hard-scrabble towns in the South, against resentful local youth and tribal military kids. And then his techniques had been broken down and built back up by the army, and he had learned the golden rule: get your retaliation in first. He stepped in close, falling forward, and threw a heavy elbow at the guy's face. Usually better to target the throat, but Reacher wanted the guy talking afterwards, not choking to death on a smashed larynx, so he went for the upper lip, just below the nose, accelerating hard, which would break teeth and bone, which would make the subsequent conversation a little garbled, but at least the guy wouldn't be struck mute. The blow landed, and the guy's head snapped back, and his knees went weak, and he sat down on his ass right there on the sidewalk, eyes all over the place, blood all over his nose and his mouth. Reacher was a brawler by nature, and a brawler's dream is to have the other guy on the floor, ready for the winning kick to the head, but he held back because he wanted a name. He said, "Last chance, my friend." The guy from the stool said, "Kubota." Garbled, missing teeth and blood and swellings, Reacher said, "Spell it for me." Which the guy did, fast and obedient, not the king of the jungle anymore, which Reacher was happy about, because human legs are hard to break. Big physical efforts are required. He asked, "Where will I find Mr. Kubota?" And the guy told him. At that point, Reacher stopped talking and took a breath and put his head back on the hospital pillow. I said, "And then what?" He said, "Enough for tonight. I'm tired. I need to know. Come back tomorrow." "What, did you find Kubota?" No answer. I said, "Was there a confrontation?" No answer. "Did Kubota shoot you?" Reacher said nothing. And then the doctor came in, the same woman, with the threads of silver in her hair. She told me she was terminating the interview immediately on medical grounds, which was frustrating, but not fatal. I had plenty of valuable data. I left the building with visions of a major score in my head, a protection racket, busted, on my very first day in the department. Priceless. Women have to work twice as hard to get half the credit. I went straight back to the station house. Unpaid, but I would have paid them. I found a thick file on Kubota. Lots of leads, lots of hours, but we never had enough to get a warrant. Well, now we did, big time. We had gun crime. We had his victim right there in the hospital. Eyewitness testimony. And possibly even the bullet itself in a stainless steel dish somewhere. Solid gold. The night judge agreed with me. He signed off on a big boilerplate warrant, and I put a team together. Plenty of uniforms, cars, heavy weapons, three other detectives, all senior to me. But I was leading them. My case. An unwritten rule. We executed the warrant at midnight, which was legal speak for busting down Kubota's door and knocking him over, and bouncing his head off the tile a couple times. We found the guy from the bar in a back room, in a bad way, like he'd been run over by a truck. I had him taken to a different hospital, under guard. Then the uniforms hauled Kubota away to a holding cell, and I and my three detective partners spent most of the rest of the night going through his place like we were looking for a tiny flake of chrome off the world's smallest needle in the world's biggest haystack. But his place was a treasure trove. We found grocery sacks full of unexplained cash and 30 different bank accounts, and notebooks and ledgers and diaries and maps. It was clear from our first glance the guy was making serious money from 100 different establishments. According to his notes, in the last 6 months, three places had tried to resist, and we called in the dates and matched them to three unexplained arson attacks. We found temporary interruptions in two sets of payments, and when we checked the dates with the city's hospitals, we found one broken leg and one slashed face. We had everything. Except the gun. But that made sense, in its way. He had used it, and he had ditched it. Standard practice. It would be in the river, thrown from a bridge. Like his old cell phones, presumably. Pay-as-you-go burners. He had ditched the packaging and the paperwork, but for some dumb reason, not the chargers. We found nearly 50 in a drawer. At dawn, I was face-to-face with him in an interview room. He had a lawyer with him, a slick guy in a suit, but I could tell by the guy's face he knew a defense was hopeless. On our side, it was just me, all alone. But I guess there was a crowd behind the one-way glass to watch the mojo working. And it worked very well, at first. I like to get a suspect in the habit of saying yes, one confession after the other. So I started with the easy stuff. I went through one bar after another, all the restaurants and diners, and I told them we had the notebooks and the ledgers and the diaries and the cash and the bank statements, and he admitted them all. 10 minutes after I started, we had enough on tape to put him away for a long, long time. But I kept him going, not because we really needed it, but because I wanted him warmed up for the big moment, which didn't happen. He denied the shooting. He denied meeting Reacher the night before. He said he'd been out of town. He denied owning a gun. He said he had never used one. I kept at him until the clock ticked around, and my second day in the department officially began. Then my lieutenant came in, fresh from a night's sleep and a shower, and he told me to quit. He said, "No harm, no foul. You've done great. We have enough. He's going down for a long time. The goal has been achieved." Which was the general opinion in the department. There was no sense of failure. Quite the reverse. The new girl had busted a racket on her first day on the job. A major score. But it rankled with me. I didn't do the work I was supposed to do. And I dug deeper. I knew I would find something. And I did. But not what I was expecting. The bar owner, Reacher had seen, was the doctor's brother-in-law, the woman with silver in her hair. They were family. I was dizzy with fatigue, which helped in a way. I made lightning connections a rational mind might have dismissed. Kubota's thick file, full of failed attempts to win a warrant. The endless quest for more, the need to see someone beaten, or worse. The relentless beep of Reacher's bedside monitor. Too strong for a sick man. His clear eyes and his lucid mind. After opiates, said to be strong enough to fell a horse. I made my third trip to the hospital. Reacher's room was empty. There were no signs of recent occupation. The woman with silver in her hair swore she had treated no gunshot victims on the night in question. She invited me to check her records. Her records were blank. I sat down with the nurses, one at a time. No one talked. Then I pictured Reacher on the night in question, unable to find Kubota because Kubota was out of town. I pictured him heading back to the bar, handing back the money, working out a long-term solution with the owner. I pictured the owner calling his sister-in-law. I pictured the Greyhound Depot at midnight, a tall figure getting on a bus, the bus rolling out, no bags, no schedule, no plan. I went back to the station house. I walked in, and they gave me a round of applause.
Not a drill. One thing leads to another, and in Jack Reacher's case, one warm and aimless August day, a hitched ride in an empty lumber truck led to East Millinocket in Maine, which led, in turn, to a decent mid-morning meal in a roadside restaurant near the highway, which led to a halting, too wary guys conversation with the man at the next table, which led to an offered ride further north, to a place called Island Falls. The unspoken but clearly implied cost of the ride was the price of the guy's coffee and pie. But the establishment was cheap, and Reacher had money in his pocket, and, as always, he had no particular place to be, so he accepted. One thing leads to another. The guy's car turned out to be a softly sprung old Chevrolet, lacy with rust, and Island Falls turned out to be a pleasant little place on a lake, way in the north, where Maine sticks out like a thumb up Canada's ass, with Quebec to the left and New Brunswick to the right. But most of all, Island Falls was pretty close to the north end of I-95, which was tempting. Reacher had a collector's instinct when it came to places. He knew the south end of I-95 pretty well, more than 1,900 miles away, just past downtown Miami. He had been there many times, but he had never seen the North End. He had no particular place to be. One thing leads to another. Getting out of Island Falls was easy enough. He had a cup of coffee in a hut next to a kayak rental slip and stood in the buggy warmth of the lake shore and took in the view. And then he turned his back on it all and walked out of town the same way the old Chevy had driven in, back to the highway Cloverleaf. He set up on the on-ramp, heading north, and waited. Not long, he figured. It was August. It was warm. It was vacation country. The mood was amiable. It was daylight. He was clean. His clothes were only 2 days old, and his shave was only three. Ideal conditions overall. And sure enough, less than 10 minutes later, an old model Jeep SUV with New Brunswick plates slowed and stopped. There was a woman at the wheel, and a man next to her in the passenger seat. They looked to be somewhere in their mid-thirties, clearly outdoor types, ruffled by the wind and tanned by the sun. heading home, no doubt, after an active vacation. Maybe they'd been kayaking, or camping, or both. The load space in the rear of the truck was all piled up with stuff. The guy in the passenger seat let his window down, and the woman craned over for a look, too. The guy said, "We're only going to Fredericton, which isn't far, I'm afraid. Any good to you?" Reacher said, "Is that in Canada?" "It sure is." Reacher said, "Then that's perfect. All I want is to get to the border and then back again." "You got something against Canada?" "My passport expired." The guy nodded. Gone were the days when a person could just stroll in and out of neighboring countries. Then the guy said, "But there's nothing much to see between here and there. Nothing much to see through the fence, either. You'd be better off staying where you are, surely." Reacher said, "I want to see the end of the road." The guy said, "Oh, that sounds heavy." The woman said, "We think of it as the beginning of the road." "Good point," Reacher said. The guy said, "Hop in the back." He craned around in his seat and batted stray items aside. Reacher opened the door and slid in, and used his hip to finish the job. He closed the door, and the woman hit the gas, and they took off, cruising easy through the last 30-some miles of America. The last exit was for a town called Halton, or the first exit, Reacher supposed, from the Canadian point of view. Then came a mile or so of hinterland, and a little queuing traffic, and barriers and booths and official signs. Reacher stayed in the jeep until the last car's length, and then he said his thanks and his goodbyes, and he slipped out. And he stepped ahead and put his foot on the last inch of blacktop, directly under the barrier pole. The end of the road. One thing leads to another. He looped back and crossed to the southbound lanes and set up again 30 yards from the barriers. He wanted to give incoming drivers plenty of time to see him, but not enough time to be already going too fast to stop. Once again, he anticipated no kind of a lengthy delay. August, daylight, sunshine, vacation country. Warm-hearted and relaxed Canadian drivers full of generosity and goodwill. 10 minutes max, he thought, maybe closer to 5, and it wasn't outside the bounds of possibility that the first car through would be the one. It wasn't, but the second car was, which was more of a minivan, really, but not the kind of thing a soccer mom would be proud of. It was old and grimy, and somewhat battered, light blue maybe when it left the factory, but now colorless almost, faded by sun and salt. There was a young man at the wheel, and a young woman beside him in the front, and another young woman in the back. The van had New Brunswick plates, and it was trailing a puff of oil smoke after pulling away from the customs post. But Reacher had ridden in worse vehicles. It slowed and stopped alongside him. The passenger window was already down. The woman in the front said, "We're headed for Naismith?" Which was a place Reacher had never heard of. He said, "I'm not sure where that is." The guy at the wheel leaned across and said, "The Allegash, man, about an hour west of Route 11, after going north for a bit. It's a little town, where you get on the wilderness trail through the forest. It's a really cool place." Reacher said, "North of here?" The guy said, "Beautiful country, man. You should see those woods, really primeval. Step off the path, and you could be the first human ever to set foot. I mean, literally, 10,000 years of undisturbed nature, since the last ice age." Reacher said nothing. The guy said, "Get it while you can, my friend. It won't be there forever. Climate change is going to take it all down." No particular place to be. Reacher said, "Okay, sure, thanks." One thing leads to another. He looped around the rear of the van, and the girl in the back slid the door on a rusty track, and he climbed in. Behind him, in the load space, were 2 big backpacks and 1 hard-shell suitcase. The seat was some kind of nylon cloth, gone greasy with age. He got settled and slid the door closed, and the van moved off, puffing smoke again from the effort. "Thanks," Reacher said for the second time. The trio introduced themselves. The girl in the back was Helen, and the girl in the front was Suzanne, and the driver was Henry. Henry and Suzanne were a couple. They ran a bicycle store in a place called Moncton. Helen was their friend. The plan was Henry and Suzanne would walk the Wilderness Trail north from Naismith to a place called Cripps, which would take 4 days. Helen would be waiting there with the van to meet them, having spent the same 4 days doing something else, maybe antiquing in Presque Isle and Caribou.
"I don't like the woods," she said,
as if she felt an explanation was required.
"Why not?"
Reacher asked, because he felt a response was expected.
"Too creepy," she said. "Too dark. Too full of bugs."
They puttered onward past Halton, and then Henry turned off on 212, which soon joined Route 11 going north, which was a pretty road. Saddleback Mountain was ahead on the right, and on the left was an endless expanse of woods and lakes. The trees were green, and the water glittered, and the sky was blue. Beautiful country, just like Henry had promised.
"I don't like the woods," Helen said again.
She was in her late 20s, Reacher guessed, maybe 30 tops. She was paler than her friends, and sleeker and more cared for. Indoor, more than outdoor. Urban, rather than rural. Like her luggage. She was a hard-shell suitcase, not a backpack. Henry and Suzanne were stockier and tousled and windburned, but no older. Maybe they had all been college friends together, still a threesome, more than 5, but less than 10 years after graduation. Henry said,
"The woods are actually awesome, Helen."
He said it kindly, full of enthusiasm, no hint of confrontation or scolding, just a guy who loved the woods, unable to understand why his friend didn't. He seemed genuinely intrigued by the possibility that he could walk where no other human had ever trod in all of history. Reacher asked where they were all from originally, and it turned out that Henry and Suzanne were from the suburbs of Toronto and Vancouver, respectively. And it was Helen, who was the real country girl, from what she called the trackless wastes of northern Ontario province, in which case he figured she was entitled to her opinion. She had earned it, presumably. Then they asked where he was from, and his bio filled the next few miles. The Marine family, always moving. The dozen elementary schools, the dozen high schools, then West Point, then the U.S. Army, the military police. Always moving all over again. Some of the same countries, some new. Never in one place long enough to notice. Then the drawdown and the discharge and the wandering. The hitched rides, the walking, the motels, the aimlessness. No particular place to be. Henry thought it was all very cool. Suzanne less so, Reacher thought, and he figured Helen didn't think it was cool at all. They slowed and turned left onto a narrow rural two-lane that speared straight west through the trees. There was a rusted enamel sign that said, Naismith, 40 miles. It was possible the road had once had shoulders, but they were long overgrown with underbrush and broadleaf trees that reached 40 feet tall. In places, their branches met overhead, so that for hundreds of yards at a time, it was like driving through a green tunnel. Reacher watched out the windows, left and right. Either side, he could see not more than 5 or 6 feet into the vegetation. He wondered how much more primeval woods could get. Brambles and brush were tangled thigh-high, and the air looked dank and still. The ground looked soft and springy, densely matted with leaf litter, damp and fecund. The blacktop ribbon ahead had turned gray with age, and the heat it was holding made the air above it thick with tiny insects. After 5 miles, the windshield was soupy with slime from a million separate impacts. Reacher asked, "Have you been here before?"
"Once," Henry said. "We walked south to Center Mountain, which was boring, man. I like to stay below the tree line. I guess I'm a forest dweller."
"Are there animals in there?"
"Oh, bears, for sure. Plenty of small stuff, obviously, but the underbrush never gets eaten, so there's no deer, which is interesting as to why. Predation, most likely. But by what? Mountain lions, maybe, or wolves. But no one ever sees them or hears them. But there's something in there, that's for sure."
"You sleep in a tent?"
"Pup tent," he said. "No biggie. Double bag your food, wash around your mouth in a stream, and there's nothing for the critters to smell. Bears like to eat, but if you don't lay out a picnic for them, they'll leave you alone. But you know all this, right? I mean, doesn't the army train everywhere? I thought you got sent out in every kind of terrain."
"Not in a forest like this," Reacher said. "Can't move through it. Certainly can't move vehicles through it. Can't shoot through it. Clearing it with napalm and explosives would take forever, so we'd have to maneuver around it. Best kind of natural barrier there is." They drove on, over a surface that got progressively worse. The encroaching brush had nibbled out fist-sized bites of blacktop on both sides, and then tree roots had punched out deeper holes, and the winter freezes had elongated the cracks, and the state's fixes had been infrequent and hasty. The old van's suspension creaked and pattered. Overhead, the green tunnels became more or less continuous. In places, leafy vines hung down and whipped the roof. Then, exactly an hour after leaving Route 11, there was a cleared length of shoulder with a board sign on it, which had words burned into it with a hot poker: "Welcome to Naismith, the gateway to the wilderness," which Reacher felt was about an hour too late. He felt that particular threshold had been passed long ago. Henry slowed the van, and the road curved to the left, and came out in a clearing about the size of a football stadium. Dead ahead was a lake, shaped like a crooked finger, first pointing north and then curling east. The road became a kind of main street, leading straight to the shore. At the far end was a kayak pier, and left and right were low wooden buildings, with vacation cabins near the water, and a general store and a diner and small residences further from it. There were side streets made of the same battered gray blacktop. Naismith, Maine, a miniature town in the middle of nowhere. Suzanne said,
"I'm hungry."
"I'll buy lunch," Reacher said. "That's the least I can do." Henry parked the van in front of the diner and shut down the motor. The world went silent. They all climbed out, and they all stood and stretched. The air was somewhere halfway between fresh and heavy, the tang of the lake water mixed with the smell of the trees, and there was no sound beyond a subliminal drone from a billion tiny insect wings. There was no wind, no rustling leaves, no lapping waves, just hot stillness. The diner was all wood, inside and out, rough-stained boards worn shiny in places by hands and elbows and shoulders. There were pies and glass cases, and 8 square tables draped in red checkered tablecloths. The waitress was a flinty woman of about 60, wearing a pair of men's eyeglasses and carpet slippers. 2 tables were occupied, both by people who looked more like Henry and Suzanne than Helen. The waitress pointed to an empty table and went to get menus and glasses of water. The food was the same as Reacher had eaten in 1,000 other diners, but it was adequate, and the coffee was fresh and strong, so he was happy. As were the others, not that they were paying much attention to what they were eating and drinking. They were talking amongst themselves, running through their plans, which sounded straightforward enough. They were all going to spend the night in pre-booked cabins, and at first light, Henry and Suzanne were going to set out walking, and Helen was going to drive back to Route 11 and look for whatever she could find. 4 days later, they were all going to meet again at the far end of the trail. Simple as that. Reacher paid the check, said his goodbyes, and left them there. He didn't expect to see them again. From the diner, he strolled down to the kayak pier and walked out to the end of it, and stood with his toes above open water. The lake was a bright blue spear pointing north and then turning east into the distance, more than 10 miles long probably, but not more than a couple hundred yards across at its widest bulge. Overhead was a vast high bowl of summer sky, completely cloudless, unmarked, except for wispy contrails 8 miles up, from transatlantic jet planes heading to and from Europe, in and out of Boston and New York and Washington, D.C. Great circle routes, way up over Canada and Greenland, and then dropping down again to London and Paris and Rome. Straight lines on a spherical planet, but not on a flat paper map. At ground level, the forest crowded in on both sides of the lake, unbroken, a continuous green canopy covering everything that wasn't liquid. There were hundreds and hundreds of square miles of it. 10,000 years of undisturbed nature, Henry had said, which was exactly what it looked like. The earth had warmed, the glaciers had retreated, seeds had blown in, rain had fallen, and 100 generations of trees had grown and died and grown again. Elsewhere on the giant continent, people had cut them down to clear fields for farming, or for lumber to build houses, or to burn in stoves and steam locomotives. But some parts had been left alone, and maybe always would be. You could be the first human ever to set foot, Henry had said, and Reacher had no doubt he was right. He walked back past the vacation cabins, which were all quiet. People were out and about in other places, clearly, doing whatever it was they were there to do. He found a turn to the left, which was basically north, where there was 100-yard side street, which he followed, and at the end of it, he found a wooden arch, lashed together from bark-stripped trunks stained dark brown, like a ceremonial thing. A literal gateway to the wilderness. Beyond it, the trail started. It ran straight for 20 yards, all beaten flat by booted feet, and then it turned a corner and disappeared. Next stop, the town called Cripps, 4 days away. He stepped under the arch and stood still on the first yard of the trail. Then he moved forward 20 paces to the first turn. He took it and walked onward, another 20 paces, another 20 yards, and stopped again. The trail was about 4 feet wide. Either side, the forest crowded in. The trunks were spiked with dead branches all the way to the canopy far overhead. The trees had grown tall and straight, racing for the light. They were 2 or 3 feet apart in some places, and more or less touching in others. Some were ancient and mature, all gnarled and burled and a yard across, and some were younger and slimmer and paler, exploiting the gaps like opportunistic weeds. Below chest height, the undergrowth was dense and tangled, a mess of dark-leaved thorny runners, snaking among dry and brittle twigs. The air was still and completely silent. The light was green and dim. He turned a full circle. He was 40 yards from the ceremonial arch, but he felt like he was a million miles from anywhere. He walked on, another 20 paces. Nothing changed. The path wandered left and right a little. He guessed some kind of parks authority kept the underbrush trimmed back and left it to passing feet to crush new seedlings. He guessed without that kind of human intervention, the trail would close up in a year or two, three tops. It would become impassable, reclaimed by nature. He guessed wider bulges had been hacked out here and there for campsites, for the pup tents, near streams maybe. There was nowhere else to sleep the night. He stood for a minute more, in the green-filtered light and the eerie silence. Then he turned around and walked back to Naismith's token Main Street, and he followed it out the way they had driven in, to the board sign on the shoulder, with the welcome. But there was no traffic leaving town, and after a moment's reflection, he realized there wouldn't be, not until the next morning. Presumably the checkout time for the vacation cabins was 11 or noon, which meant that day's exodus was already over. The diner and the general store would need occasional deliveries, but the odds were long that a returning truck would be passing by any time soon. He stood in the heavy silence a minute longer, for no real reason other than he was enjoying it, and then he retraced his steps through the town toward the lake. The vacation cabins were laid out haphazardly, like a handful of dice thrown down. Reacher figured the location furthest from the water would be the least desirable, and sure enough, found it was being used as some kind of a resident manager's accommodations, with a front room done up as an office, with one of its window panes converted to an opening hutch, which had a shelf behind it with a little brass bell and a ballpoint pen on a chain. He rang the bell, and a long moment later an old guy stepped up, slowly, like he had arthritis. Yes, he had vacancies. The overnight charge was a modest sum. Reacher paid cash, and signed his name with the pen on the chain, and got a key in return to what turned out to be a tiny wooden house that smelled hot and moldy. Not a prime position, but it had a partial sideways view of the lake. The rest of the view was all trees, inevitably. There was a bed and two chairs, and a bathroom and kitchen facilities, and a short shelf with creased and battered paperback books on it. Outside, in back, there was a small deck with two folding chairs, slung with faded and sun-rotted fabric. Reacher spent the rest of the afternoon in one of them, with his feet up on the other, reading a book from the shelf, warm, alone, relaxed, as happy as he could remember being. He woke at 7 in the morning, but lay in bed a whole extra hour, stretched out like a starfish, to let the walkers and the boaters get through the diner ahead of him. He figured they would be looking for an early start. He wasn't. He figured about 10 o'clock would be optimum, to catch the first wave of departures. A ride back to Route 11 was all he needed. To I-95 would be a bonus, and Bangor or Portland or any place further south would be the icing on the cake. He figured he would head to New York next. Yankees tickets would be easy to get. The dog days of summer, folks out of town, plenty of space in the high seats in the sun. He showered and dressed and packed, which consisted of folding his toothbrush and putting it in his pocket. He saw the maid on her way between two other cabins, and told her his was vacant and ready for her. She looked like she could have been the waitress's sister from the diner, and probably was. He walked on, thinking about coffee and pancakes, and a corner table in a quiet, empty room, and maybe someone's abandoned newspaper to read. He didn't get the quiet, empty room. Henry and Suzanne were in there, with about 9 other people, all milling about, all talking in a tense and agitated fashion, like a scene in a movie where folks find out the mining company has poisoned their water. They all turned to look at him as he stepped inside. He said, "What's up?" Henry said, "They closed the trail." "Who did?" "The cops. State, I think. They strung tape across the entrance."
"When?"
"In the night."
"Why?"
"No one knows."
"They won't tell us," Suzanne said. "We've been calling all morning. All they'll say is the trail is closed until further notice."
Another guy said,
It's closed at Cripps, too. We started that end last year. I still have the motel number. Same situation. Tape between the trees.
Reacher said, It's a 4-day walk, right? There must be a bunch of people still in there. Maybe something happened.
Then why won't they tell us?
Reacher said nothing. Not his problem. All he wanted was pancakes and coffee, more urgently. He looked for the waitress and caught her eye and found an empty table. Henry followed him straight to it.
Can they do that?
Reacher said.
Do what? Close the trail like that?
They just did.
Is it legal?
How would I know?
You were a cop.
I was a military cop. I wasn't a park ranger.
It's a public resource.
I'm sure there's a good reason. Maybe someone got eaten by a bear. One by one, the whole disgruntled group came over and gathered around. 11 people standing up, Reacher sitting down. The guy who still had the number for the Cripps Motel asked,
How do you know that?
Reacher said, Know what?
That someone got attacked by a bear.
I said, Maybe. Like a joke.
Bear attacks aren't very funny.
A guy said, Maybe it's just a drill.
What kind of drill?
Like a rehearsal. For a medical emergency, maybe. For the first responders.
Then why would they say until further notice? Why wouldn't they say until lunchtime today or some such?
Another guy asked,
Who should we call?
Suzanne said,
They're not telling us anything.
Oh, we could try the governor's office.
Another woman said,
Like he's going to tell us anything if the others aren't.
It can't be bears.
Then what is it?
I don't know.
Suzanne looked at Reacher and said,
What should we do?
Reacher said, Go for a walk someplace else.
We can't. We're stuck here. Helen's got the van.
She left already?
She didn't want to eat breakfast here.
Can't you call her?
No bars.
Bars aren't open yet.
I mean, no cell phone coverage here. We can't call her. We tried from the payphone in the store. She's off the network somewhere.
So, go kayaking instead. That's probably just as much fun. Henry said,
I don't want to go kayaking. I want to walk the trail.
Eventually, the small crowd wandered away again, out through the door to the parking lot, still mumbling and grumbling, and the waitress came by to take Reacher's order. He ate and drank in silence, and he got the check, and he paid in cash. He asked the waitress, Does the trail get closed a lot? She said, It never happened before.
Did you see who did it?
She shook her head. I was asleep.
Where's the nearest state police barracks?
The kayak owner says it was soldiers.
Does he?
She nodded.
He says he saw them.
In the middle of the night?
She nodded again.
He lives nearest the arch. They woke him up.
Reacher put an extra dollar on her tip and walked out to the street. He turned right and took a step in the direction of out of town, but then he stopped and went back and found the 100-yard side street that led to the trail. Henry and Suzanne were right there at the arch, just the two of them. They had their backpacks on. The arch had tape tied across it, 3 lengths, 1 knee-high, 1 waist-high, and 1 chest-high, all 2-inch plastic ribbon, blue and white, twisted on itself in places, saying, Police line, do not cross. Henry said,
See?
Reacher said, I believed you the first time.
So what do you think?
I think the trail is closed. Henry turned away and stared at the tape, like he could make it dematerialize by willpower alone. Reacher walked back to Main Street and onward out of town, to the welcome board on the shoulder. 10 minutes, he thought, maybe less. He figured that morning's exodus would be brisker than normal. But the first vehicle he saw was coming, not going. Into town, not out. And it was a military vehicle, a Humvee to be precise, painted up in black and green camouflage. It roared past, all thrashing gears and whining tires. It took the curve and disappeared. Four guys in it, hard men, all in the new Army combat uniform. Reacher waited. A minute later, a car came driving out of town, but it was full. Two in the front, two in the back. No room for a hitchhiker, especially one as large as Reacher. He recognized people he had seen in the diner, disconsolate and complaining, boots on and ready, backpacks piled in the corner, no place to go. He waited. Next up was another Humvee, heading in, not out. Roaring engine, thrashing drivetrain, howling tires, four guys wearing ACUs. Reacher watched it around the corner, and even at a distance, he heard it slow and change gear and speed up again. A right-hand turn, he thought, and he would have bet the few bucks in his pocket it was heading for the wooden arch. He stared after it, thinking. Then another car came driving out of town. A sedan. Two people. An empty back seat. The driver was the guy who still had the number for the motel in Cripps. He slowed down and stopped, and the woman next to him buzzed her window down. She asked, "Where are you headed?" Reacher said nothing. She said, "We're going back to Boston." Which would have been great. 3 hours from New York. Multiple routes. Lots of traffic. But Reacher said, "I'm sorry, but I changed my mind. I'm going to stay here." The woman shrugged, and the car took off without him. He walked back to the cabin rental office and rang the bell. His cabin was still available. He paid for another night and got the same key in return. Then he headed for the arch, 100 yards along the side street, and when he got there, he found the two Humvees and their 8 occupants. The Humvees were parked side by side, nose out, blocking the whole width of the road. Their occupants already had their boots on the ground. They were all armed with M16s. They were setting up an exclusion zone. Reacher knew the signs. 2 squads, 4 hours on, 4 hours off. Military police, for sure. Reacher knew those signs, too. Not the National Guard, either. Regular U.S. Army. Not a drill. No one was going to get past them. There was no sign of Henry or Suzanne. Reacher said,